Everything we do is music.
Acoustic space. Boundless, directionless, horizonless.
36.
20.
On a light so it burns in the night.
Welcome to 3620, podcasting from the basement of 3620 Walnut Street by the doctoral students of the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. I'm your host, Aaron Shapiro. This week on 3620, we have the privilege of sharing a work in progress. Veteran producers and former 3620 hosts Kevin Gotkin and Karina Laughlin join with new producer Mariam Durrani to have a conversation about the podcast phenomenon known as Serial. But really, this episode is about everything that we're trying to do here at 3620. It's about sound scholarship. It's about the blurred lines between knowledge production and entertainment in the digital age. It's about affect, voice, and the types of work that new media formats can and cannot accomplish. What you'll hear is a draft of an audio essay that Kevin, Karina, and Mariam will be publishing along with a special issue of the journal American Anthropologist, which is, I think, truly an incredible feat. So take a listen. I think you're going to like it.
I think about you and what you'll grow to be. Black and white blotches to watch and not get. And then flashes of sense along with your body and head.
All right, guys, so did he do it?
Yes, he totally did it.
I'm not convinced.
Here's why he did it. Because it's always the boyfriend. It's Occam's razor.
But also the guy who discovered her body.
Yeah. What was that?
That guy?
Across the country this fall, conversations just like this were going on.
That was a very suspicious.
And then when the cops showed up, they can't even find where she's buried.
That was a red herring.
No, for those reasons, you can't put this man in jail. Like, it's just not enough. You can't do it because somebody feels it. You have to know.
Okay, but
we're talking about Serial here, a podcast created by investigative journalist and This American Life producer Sarah Koenig. Koenig's idea was to serialize a single story into multiple episodes. And she claims she chose this particular story about the murder of an 18-year-old high school student, Haman Lee, allegedly by Adnan Syed, Lee's ex-boyfriend, because it fell into her lap. A friend of Adnan Syed's brought the case to Koenig, and Koenig agreed to pursue it, episode by episode.
From This American Life and WBEZ Chicago, it's Serial, one story told week by week. I'm Sarah Koenig.
What followed was remarkable. In November 2014, the New York Times reported that Serial was getting around 1.5 million downloads per episode. It spawned both amateur and professional parodies. A subreddit emerged in which amateur investigators dug up details about the case. In short, Serial became a cultural phenomenon. Three of us,
Mariam Durrani,
Kevin Gotkin,
and Karina Laughlin, all fans of the show, recently came together to talk about why Serial was so popular.
Okay, cool.
Oh, sorry, we're currently recording.
Correct.
And how we, as academics, might harness the podcast medium for anthropological and ethnographic research. What can we, as academics, learn from the popularity of this podcast?
First, what is a podcast? The word podcast is a portmanteau, combining iPod, the game-changing portable media player released in 2001, and broadcasting. Podcasting emerged into a swell of digital revolutionary sentiment, partly because its simplicity was proof of the prowess of amateur media producers. Podcasts are themselves the combination of audio files and a syndication system, the RSS feed, that pushes new content to audience members' portable devices automatically. When RSS collided with the popularity of the iPod and a growing number of media producers with access to editing platforms, the podcast was born in 2004. In 2005, the new Oxford American Dictionary named podcast the word of the year. When you consider the technical system of podcasting, it's not hard to see why podcasters started calling their content shows, with episodes emerging on a regular basis. Podcasting's automatic syndication lends itself to seriality. As with its sibling medium, radio, podcasting benefits greatly from commuters, many by car, who listen to their podcasts in their own serialized daily habits of travel. Emerging about 10 years after the inception of the podcasting medium, the Serial podcast names this technical tendency in its title. But of course, Serial is not really named for how it's delivered to its listeners. It is named for the weekly release of the clues Koenig follows in her attempt to find out whether Adnan Syed murdered his ex-girlfriend in early 1999. Part of what makes Serial so popular, and as many listeners profess, so addicting, is how well it fits into the true crime genre, buttressed by the promise of an investigative journalist to answer that burning question at the center of the series. Did he do it?
I think that there are other people involved. Like, maybe, I think maybe he was set up. I think he was set up somehow.
Yeah, I mean, who else did it? You know, there's like, running out of suspects.
In the late 1970s, Italian theorist Carlo Ginzburg began to write about what he called an evidentiary paradigm of clues across the human sciences and humanities. He shows that from art history's investment in forgeries to Freud's fascination with the divine secrets and concealed things in the psyche to criminology's primordial investment in collecting and cataloging evidence, the clue's the thing. In anthropology, too, clues are a compelling way to think about what the ethnographer seeks during fieldwork. The contested investments in empiricism question what ethnographic methods actually allow us to see or represent. Ethnographers are often caught between close-range details they gather in the field and the macro-level structures these clues promise to reveal. Now, Sarah Koenig is not a detective, something she emphasizes to make clear her project is journalistic at heart. But if we recognize that detection is at least partly baked into the way we understand inquiry of all kinds, including academic and journalistic, would it be so odd to think that Sarah Koenig and Serial have something to teach us?
As academics, we want our research to reach a broader audience than just our community of scholars working on the same subject. Anthropologists often wonder if the discipline as we want to believe has the potential to change the world, to encourage greater cultural sensitivity, to bring institutional accountability, if it could facilitate transparency in social and political matters, as Rob Borofsky discusses in his book, Why Public Anthropology. Then, as he asks, why hasn't cultural anthropology lived up to its transformative potential? And how might it be encouraged to do so now? Media has been lodged at the center of how anthropologists collect, analyze, and circulate data since at least Clifford Geertz's imploration for researchers to circumscribe their ethnographic documentations with thick description. And visual anthropologists are particularly sensitive to the ways that the technologies we use in the field, the film camera, for example, become integral ways to literally and conceptually frame the research artifacts. So as media anthropologists, we should add the podcast to this mix, taking up how the form itself helps us engage with classic questions about authority, authorship, and representation. Perhaps recent reflections on blogging might parallel the possibilities for podcasting. A few months ago, David Price wrote an essay in American Anthropologist on blogging anthropology, where he describes some of the existing options for publishing research blogs. In this, Price points out that while this format is not competitive with peer-reviewed scholarship, it is nonetheless becoming anthropologists' new electronic polis. These online platforms offer a unique site for public anthropology because in the digital space, we have no editorial barriers between writing something and quickly sending it out into the world. So if the question is whether podcasting, like blogging, can be a venue for anthropology's public engagements, where can we look for models to help us get started?
Some have said that we're experiencing a podcast renaissance, as podcasts like Serial, 99% Invisible, This American Life, Planet Money, and many others continue to reach people through their mobile devices. How can we harness inspiration from this popularity while also beginning to imagine what a research podcast might sound like? One experiment we can point to is the 3620 podcast, produced by the doctoral students of the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, including Kevin and myself, which experiments with ways to present research, including ethnographic research, in an aural medium.
Acoustic space, boundless, directionless, horizonless.
36, 20,
20. In our experiments with the podcast format, we have had to address questions that just don't come up in our writing. For example, how can we establish authority through our vocal registers? How are arguments made in sound? And how might we balance the aesthetics of this medium with the imperative to present sound research? At the center of questions about the style and aesthetics of podcasting is the voice. We know, of course, that Koenig's voice is carefully styled to realize the goals that she and public radio generally set up. The parodies of Koenig's voice to the point of memification are in some sense an indication that the public radio voice has a recognizable aesthetic that helps Koenig tell her story.
For the past year, I've been talking to Chris, a 1,000-year-old toy maker who lives up north. It should be noted that Chris is part of a population who identify themselves as elves. They're a minority in the United States, often looked at as shifty, secretive. But I'll get to that later.
On a theoretical level, what do we mean by voice? Linguistic anthropologists often look to Bakhtin's conception of voice, which is concerned with how speech utterances index identifiable speaking personae, meaning how a particular way of speaking draws from a much larger social field, where we can link the speech forms to class, profession, slang, etc. The typifiability of voices is premised by an understanding that listeners can perceive voice in contrast. When we listen to serials characters, just their voices, their accents, the use of a particular phrase, all are categorized based on what we know about American speakers and their voices. Asif Aga speaks about a class of social voices that are linked to what he calls registers. A register, something like legalese or military speech, is a, quote, reflexive model of language use that is disseminated along identifiable trajectories in social space through communicative processes, end quote. I know it's a mouthful, but the concept describes many mouthfuls. Returning to Koenig's podcasting style, we can see an instantiation of a socially recognizable public radio voice that she is drawing from. But as Aga points out, it's never so simple. A register is never static. Rather, speakers are constantly troping and pulling from many different voices, or what Bakhtin has talked about as heteroglossia. Koenig is also a white, upper-middle-class American woman. Her use of the quotative like, vocal fry, uptalk or rising intonation, and other stylings are pulling from a kind of valley girl speak made popular by films like Clueless. We continue to hear it everywhere. Like, really, though.
Kim and Chloe just don't get it.
Okay, so we start at the college.
So cute.
Just kind of like my, you know, motto.
The only reason why I'm going is just to like network.
You love him, and he totally complimented
Tyler
you.
Tyler has a pretty good reputation in this business.
The Valley Girl was born. She brought us like and uptalk and vocal fry.
And Koenig certainly pulls from and laminates these multiple voices, the public radio register, the Valley Girl register, among others, to create the highly stylized voice that we hear on Serial. We know that public radio strategically deploys a particular social voice that has been carefully crafted to convey authority, but also a kind of intimacy. Conversely, as academics, we write with disciplinary voices that often shun intimacy in favor of a seemingly neutral, objective voice. Academic textual practice has been a process of concealing the body, of which the voice is an important part. Thus, even though we know that registers are central to how every speaker communicates, the podcast form opens up what academics have tried to cover over. Koenig's use of the public radio voice certainly gives her authority as the storyteller or journalist, but perhaps if anthropologists start making podcasts, it would be more difficult or actually impossible to conceal our subjectivities, and that possibility produces a lot of anxiety for us anthropologists. Of course, the anthropological project is preoccupied with this very question of subjectivity, especially in relation to how ethnographers tell other people's stories. And Koenig is telling the story. She's framing the lives of two people, a young Korean-American woman, Haemin Lee, and her Pakistani-American boyfriend, Adnan Sayed. The fact that their story concerns an interracial relationship and that Lee's murder was framed by the courts as an honor killing makes this story a particularly sensitive one to tell. Given both the popularity of Serial and the dearth of media representations of Muslim Americans, Serial has become a form of public anthropology about these minority communities. In fact, it is now being used as a pedagogical tool in a Harvard undergraduate course.
Zarina Grewal, a Harvard anthropologist, discussed on social media that she is trying to figure out how to teach Serial, which she describes as a, quote, refreshing, complex representation of American Muslims no matter how you assign guilt and innocence, end quote. For Grewal, it appears that the inadequacies of Koenig's representation are balanced by the fact that her work has created the space to even have this conversation. But many would hesitate here. Not just any representation will do, but one that stands up to the ethical standards that scholars have long used to evaluate the rigor and responsibility of our research. For example, there's a line from the first episode where Koenig makes a flippant comment about Adnan and Hayes' relationship that we, in our discussion, were stuck on.
I read a few newspaper clips about the case, looked up a few trial records, and on paper, the case was like a Shakespearean mashup. Young lovers from different worlds, thwarting their families, secret assignations, jealousy, suspicion, and honor besmirched. The villain, not a Moor exactly, but a Muslim all the same. And a final act of murderous revenge.
And I always, when I heard that, I just had to like type it out because I was like, wait, what did she just say? Like, what kind of references did she just make to like our
collective? Wait, that must be Othello.
Collective, like, it is. It's from Othello, but it's mixing Othello, Romeo and Juliet, and then kind of this collective kind of understanding of Muslimness, which spans Shakespearean kind of representations of that era, yeah, of the Moor, till today when we have a Pakistani American guy from Baltimore who is now being clumped in with this like Muslim male category that has existed apparently like monolithically throughout like time, and it's like the way that she does that, I think for the large part, unless you are sensitive to it, you don't hear it.
Ultimately, Koenig only sporadically interrogates her position as a white journalist producing representations about people of color with different representations to, well, this American life. And who is she speaking to? Data on podcasting audiences show that Koenig's listeners are wealthier and more educated than most Americans, a fact that should trouble us in the same way that the university's own unwitting perpetuation of unequal distribution to higher education troubles us. As anthropologists, we find her storytelling lacking in precisely what our discipline has spent its time teasing out about who is speaking and being heard. When we sat down to talk about Serial, it was ethical loopholes like this one that struck us the most. What we started to realize is that Koenig signals her findings in the face of uncertainty in a very different way than we do in the academy.
But, I mean, just thinking about it as a researcher, would I do the things that she did? Absolutely not. Would this be able to pass IRB? I don't think so. I mean, I think that her not having the permission of Hayes' family, that to me, I think, is unethical.
There's the other ethical critique about the opportunity cost involved in this, right? She's Sarah Koenig is one of the best public radio reporters, has cut her teeth in a lot of different journalistic domains, and that you could always raise the question if there should have been a better story. She even starts the whole series by saying, for everyone who's going to ask me why this story, it fell into my lap. And I think a lot of people could respond and say that's really not actually the best way to answer that question the criminal justice system has so many stories that need to be told.
Ultimately, we wondered if these questions of ethics, of the politics of representation, of self-reflexivity, all the shortcuts Koenig took that we wouldn't, might be part of the reason why an academic version of Serial might not ever be as popular. Are academics afraid of style, of aesthetics? We certainly do not want to be accused of creating entertainment at the cost of creating knowledge, and Serial could be accused of being merely a piece of entertainment, a particularly problematic criticism given that it concerns a real-life murder. But what we mean by entertainment is actually a complicated milieu between researcher, informant, and audience. Questions of style in podcasting, from how we signal uncertainty and present clues to how we tell the stories of others, throws established means of representation in the academy into sharp relief. So let's return to the question that appealed to millions of listeners of Serial. Did Adnan Syed kill Haman Lee? Where did Koenig's trail of clues ultimately lead?
When Rabia first told me about Adnan's case,
Certainty, one way or the other, seemed so attainable. We just needed to get the right documents, spend enough time, talk to the right people, find his alibi. And then I did find Asia, and she was real, and she remembered, and we all thought, how hard could this possibly be? We just have to keep going. And now, more than a year later, I feel like shaking everyone by the shoulders, like an aggravated cop. Don't tell me Adnan's a nice guy. Don't tell me Jay was scared. Don't tell me who might have made some five-second phone call. Just tell me the facts, ma'am. Because we didn't have them 15 years ago. And we still don't have them now.
It actually ended up being this kind of Rorschach, this inkblot test for everyone to just kind of see in it what they see in it. And it actually says maybe something about who kind of what kind of person you are.
Right. But, and she points to that directly.
Yeah.
In the end, you and know, the, what yeah. is truth?
Right.
And, you this, know, and that's how it ends. Of
this
course.
Annoyed a number of people who said, this better not just be some meditation on truth,
right.
you know, because partly because everyone knows that this is a technique, a reflection technique that This American Life has often used,
yep,
right? By ending not with a conclusion, a conclusive, just, you know, end point, but instead on a meditation, a reflection on how the process worked, which actually many academics find is our impulse, right? To say, we don't know for sure. We can't know. Things are socially constructed in the mm-hmm. world. And this is one of the central tensions. So we would understand as the continual discovery of the contingency, the social and cultural contingency of clues or of truth.
Right.
Also annoyed what was technically and stylistically featured as a positive project, which is the pursuit mm-hmm. of clues that could lead to a satisfying answer.
Clues and their serial renderings are what compel us, journalists and academics alike, to continue in the inquiries we devote ourselves to. For academics, the excited water cooler conversations about whether Adnan did or didn't kill his ex-girlfriend express a certain affinity for the satisfaction that finding and following clues can give us. The mystery for us here, however, is not to pin down anything definitive about the people we want to understand in our research. The mystery for us is how to make podcasting a viable medium for many kinds of anthropological pursuits. For the moment, Serial is the shining example of how a podcast can capture the attention of millions of Americans and make them care about the lives of a few people in Baltimore. Though we have issues with how Koenig proceeded, we as academics should not ignore her experiment. The conventions of the podcast genre are in flux, which is both exciting and anxiety-producing for academics who want to present research in this form. Serial reveals the potential for the podcast medium to be a robust site for new multivocal experiments in ethnographic representation. And as such, it may be the form of the future for the project of public anthropology. It may be our smoking gun.
The views expressed on this podcast are those of its producers and do not represent the Annenberg School for Communication, its faculty, staff, or student body. The 3620 podcast is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike International 3.0 license. That means you can remix, repost, or recycle any of the content as long as you aren't making money, you don't change the credits, and you share it under the same license.